You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jeffrey Toobin in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. In September 1988, Marty Tankleff was a Long Island teenager starting his senior year of high school when his parents, Arlene and Seymour, were murdered in their home. Soon after, Marty was arrested for the murders, and in 1990, he was convicted based on dubious evidence and a dubious confession. He was in prison for 17 years until he was released this past December when a state appellate court overturned his conviction. Marty Tankleff joins me today, right now, along with his attorney, Bruce Barquette. Welcome both to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to see you. Marty, how you doing?
Pretty well.
Pretty well?
Pretty well.
What are you up to now?
I just started my third semester of college at Hofstra University, on the way to a sociology degree, hopefully within less than a year, and from there I'll probably go to law school.
When you say your third semester, when did you do the first semesters?
At Hofstra. I got out on December 27th, and probably the second week of January, I started college at Hofstra.
As a freshman?
As a junior. When I was in prison, I attained an associate's degree.
I see.
And all of my college credits were transferred in.
Okay. There's a lot to cover here. Bruce, let's sort of start at the end. The legal proceedings involving Marty are now totally concluded, correct?
Well, not totally.
Okay.
The Attorney General's office, who was appointed as special prosecutor for Marty's case back in January, announced about a week ago that they were not going to seek to retry him, and they actually filed a motion with the court to dismiss the case against Marty.
Because what the appellate court did was ordered a new trial. They didn't say, you're free to go. So the Attorney General did an investigation about whether a new trial should proceed. They concluded no new trial.
That's correct.
That's what happened on June 30th.
And the court is due to rule on that motion on July 23rd. We fully anticipate that the court will grant the motion, but as you well know, judges are able to do what they want to do. So the case is not over until a judge signs an order dismissing the matter against Marty.
But there is no party to this case asking them to do anything except grant the order to dismiss.
Absolutely. We'll be filing a reply, if you will, to their motion, basically saying we join in the motion for slightly different legal reasons on Monday, asking for the case to be dismissed. And we anticipate that the judge will do that. But judges can do what judges can do. So until the judge signs the order, the case is still open.
Okay. Now let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up, Marty?
Port Jefferson, Long Island, in a little suburb called Belterra in Port Jefferson.
And your father did what for a living?
He primarily was an insurance man for most of my childhood, and he sold his insurance business and became an entrepreneur and invested in multiple businesses.
And it was a pretty prosperous, normal Long Island upbringing, wouldn't you say?
Very much so.
Did you have a good relationship with your parents?
I had an absolutely wonderful relationship with my parents.
Throughout,
even yes.
Through senior year of high school.
Well, I never the murders took place on my first day of senior high school, so I never got to actually go to class that senior year. But I had a great relationship with them.
The murders took place on September 7th, 1988. Correct.
Yes.
What do you remember about that day?
Complete chaos.
How did you find out your parents had been murdered?
I woke up in the morning to discover them murdered in my house.
And then what happened? Were you the person who discovered the bodies?
Yes. I was the person who called 911. I was the person who discovered my father was still alive.
And how had they been attacked? What kind of weapon?
Well,
Bruce, go ahead.
Well, the forensics show that they were both beaten and stabbed and slashed. His mom was dead when Marty woke up. His father was clinging to life and ended up being in a coma for about 6 weeks. So Marty called the police upon the discovery of his father and hadn't yet learned that his mother or even seen his mother, learned that she had died.
So a ambulance came, right away, and your mother had died already, but your father was still alive. He was taken away.
Yes.
Then what happened to you?
I was taken by the police into, I would say, central headquarters and interrogated for several hours.
And a big part of your story, of the story, is your confession, what has been called your confession. Do you remember sitting here today, your experience with the police that day? Do you remember being in that interrogation room?
Some parts of it I do.
And what do you remember about it?
Hostile environment, a constant back and forth of questioning. I remember, the lies that were told to me.
Such as,
that they did this fake phone call where they said my father was pumped full of adrenaline and he identified me as the murderer. They said they found my hair in my mother's hands, which, another lie. They said they did a humidity test and said I had taken a shower that morning, another lie.
In time, though, you did confess. Do you remember confessing?
No.
You don't remember confessing?
No.
And this was really the core of your legal problem from the very beginning, correct? I mean, the fact that the police had a confession starting the day of the murder.
Yes.
Now, what I know a lot of lay people say is, well, if he wasn't guilty, why did he confess? Marty, why don't you take a shot at that? Why would someone confess if they're not guilty?
There's really no easy answer to this. But what ends up happening is the police have you so confused that you kind of don't understand what's going on. There's also quite often you have this sense of that they lead you to believe that you just tell them whatever they want to hear and the interrogation will stop.
Do you remember wanting the interrogation to stop very much?
Without a doubt.
Bruce Burkett, Marty's lawyer, talk a little bit about the issue of false confessions, because this has been a subject that has been explored in the legal world.
Sure.
A great deal in recent years, but in 1988, when this all happened, was not a particularly well-known subject.
Well, one of the things that Barry Scheck's Innocence Project has established is that people actually are wrongfully convicted, and it's now kind of an accepted fact because we have DNA and science that proves it. 25% of the wrongful convictions that were established, and we all can agree now were wrongful convictions, were the result of false confessions. So this phenomenon, which in 1988 may be unheard of or people didn't believe, now we know is a reality. And what happened to Marty is not uncommon. What the police did to him is they took his understanding of reality at a point in time where he was extraordinarily vulnerable, virtually in shock. He's 17 years old, very much subject to manipulation, and told him that his father identified him as the murderer of his mother and the person who attacked his father. Marty's response to that, according to the police, was not, I did it and here's how. It was, could I have done it and blacked out? Could another Marty have done it? And what that represents, and this happens in many false confessions, is people, the individual, is confronted with irreconcilable facts. I know I didn't do this, and the police are telling me I did in a way that I believe what they're saying. So Marty believed them and tried to reconcile these two irreconcilable positions.
So Marty Tankliff, you were then taken into custody the day of the murder, correct?
Yes.
And so and you were in custody from that day forward? Or did you get out on bail for your trial?
I was released on bail probably about maybe about 4 weeks later.
4 weeks later, and you stayed out until you were convicted after a trial.
Yes, June 28th, 1990, I was convicted.
So there was about a two-year gap where you were preparing for your trial and out on bail. Who is Jerry Stuerman?
Jerry Stuerman was my father's business partner who owed my father close to $500,000 to $600,000 at the time of the murders.
He was known in some circles as the Bagel King.
Yes.
And what was the business relationship between the two of them?
At what point? I mean,
first of all, did you know Jerry?
I did.
And what was your relationship with him?
He was a person that my father had business with. I worked in some of the bagel stores, so I kind of had a sometimes employee-boss relationship with him. At the early stages of the business relationship, it was good. In 1988, it was deteriorated to they basically hated each other.
Because your father had lent money to Jerry Stuerman. How do you pronounce his name?
Stuerman.
Jerry Stuerman. And so that was obviously a point of tension in the relationship.
Without a doubt, yes.
Now, did you at the time ever fix on him as a possible suspect in this case?
In September when the murders took place?
Or in the period leading up to the trial?
Oh, without a doubt, yes.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
And
he was the only person my father had a problem with. He was the only person that owed my father, you know, over $500,000.
Which was a lot of money to both of them. And what was Bruce, let me just ask you, what was Jerry's position on his – where was he during the murders?
Well, I mean, he was the last person to see Marty's parents alive, or at least the father. There was a poker game that evening that was kind of a regular game that the several individuals had.
And he at the Tankliff House.
At the Tankliff House, and he was the last person to leave. He claims that he went home and has his daughter as an alibi. She says he knocked on the door because he forgot his keys, and that was his alibi. What no one knew in 1988 is that his son was selling a large quantity of cocaine out of the bagel store, and that his son was connected to an individual by the name of Joe Creedon. Joe Creedon has admitted doing collections work for the drug trade, and we were able to, through different J. Salpeter and a number of other individuals, put together a connection between Stuerman and Creedon. And what we believe happened is Stuerman let Creedon into the house, and Creedon and others committed the murders.
We are, of course, in a position here not to get their comment in response. So
They've denied it,
and I think we should just stay that on the record because, you know, we can't be accusing people of murder without getting a response from them. But this much about this case has been written about for a long time. All the cast of characters has had their chance. How did Stuerman react immediately after the murder?
Jerry Stuerman, within 24 hours, cleaned out a joint bank account, and within a few days, he faked his death, changed his appearance, fled the state, and was hiding out in a psychiatric retreat in California under an alias.
And is he still alive?
I believe so.
But he has not been cooperative in the subsequent investigation, correct? Is that right, Bruce?
That's what we're told. The Attorney General's office tried to speak to him, and he wouldn't cooperate at all.
So you go to trial in 1990, Marty, and how long was the trial?
Approximately 4 weeks of jury selection, 8 weeks of trial.
And what was your defense at the trial?
That I was innocent and Jerry Stuerman was responsible.
So the Stuerman defense was before the jury?
As much information as available to us was presented to the jury back then.
And do you remember the day, the moment you were convicted?
You know, I really don't remember it. I've seen it on TV enough times. I mean, it was after 8 days of jury deliberations.
And were you taken away that day?
I was.
I'm Jeffrey Toobin, and today for Leonard Lopate, I'm speaking with Marty Tankliff and his lawyer, Bruce Barquette, about what they went through getting Marty out of prison after 17 years. We have to take a quick break now. Stay tuned for more. I'm Jeffrey Toobin of CNN and The New Yorker, and today for Leonard Lopate, we're talking with Marty Tankliff, who was convicted in 1990 of murdering his parents, and his lawyer, Bruce Barquette, about the long struggle to have him free of this unjust conviction. So, 1990, Marty, you're convicted, and what was your sentence?
50 years to life.
And what happened then? What was the day you were convicted? Where were you taken?
I was remanded to the Suffolk County Correctional Facility.
And how long did you stay there?
Several months, because we had post-conviction hearings based on juror misconduct, withheld information. So I was convicted June 28th, and if I remember correctly, I wasn't sentenced until October 3rd or 4th.
Once you were sentenced, where did you go?
Downstate Correctional Facility in Fishkill, New York.
And how long were you there?
Just about 3 months.
And then?
Auburn Correctional Facility in Auburn, New York.
That's one of the really big ones, isn't it?
It's one of the big ones.
And how long were you there?
A few years.
And tell me about, here you are, an upper middle class kid settling into prison life, sentenced to life in prison. What was that like?
There's no really easy way to explain it. Thankfully, I had a few guys who were what I would consider old timers, people who had been around the prison system before. They recognized right away that I was innocent.
And you're talking about fellow inmates?
Fellow inmates.
And is this starting at Auburn?
It's actually starting in Downstate.
Really? Very early?
Very early on. And, you know, they give you a few pieces of advice of how to survive in prison.
Such as?
Stay away from the drugs, the gambling. Be very focused. Get into a good program. And I followed their advice.
And what do you mean a good program? What was your program as an inmate?
Early on during my incarceration, we had college programs in the prison system. So I spent as much time taking college classes, and I obtained an associate's degree.
Now, early on, did those classes go away?
Yes. Back then, the New York State and the federal government eliminated funding for prisoners. There was some political outrage that prisoners were able to get a free education, but it was the best rehabilitative program the prison system ever offered.
But in your early days, in the early 90s, you were able to take some classes. What were your fellow inmates like?
Well, they were convicted murderers, rapists, robbers, thieves. Some of them were individuals that were innocent. Some of them were guilty. Some of them were guys that made just bad mistakes that were in prison.
Were you scared of them?
Every day in prison, you have a fear, but you never let that show.
Did you have a roommate?
No.
You did not have a roommate?
No. The New York State prison system was essentially a single-cell prison system.
So you didn't have to watch your back in when you were locked down?
No.
But how did you keep your spirit together?
I have a wonderful family. My parents, raised me with a lot of spirit, with a lot of motivation. My mother's two sisters, Marcella Falby and Marion McClure. My father's brother, Norman Tankliff, and his wife. My cousins, Ron and Carol Falby. I mean, I have a huge family, and I have a huge friend network. And they were able to keep me, motivated every step of the way.
And even month after month, year after year, you didn't feel like this is just all over and I'm going to just spend 50 years to life here?
No. I knew I would get out, and, I knew every day when I woke up in the morning, I wasn't the only one fighting for me because my family knew I was innocent, the public knew I was innocent, so nobody gave up on the fight.
Did the days pass slowly? Is it hard to pass time in prison?
You have to become motivated and involved in something.
Well, can you just talk about what a typical day was like in prison?
For most of almost 13 years, I worked in the prison law libraries.
I see.
So I would try to spend as much time in the prison law library as possible. Outside of that, I would try to exercise for an hour a day. And when I was back in my cell, I would, read, work on my case, listen to music.
So you were capable of getting into kind of a routine?
Oh, without a doubt. Depending on what prison I was in, the law library was usually open from 5 to 7 days a week, and I would spend anywhere from 8 to 10 hours a day in the law library.
We're talking with Marty Tankliff, who served 17 years for a crime he did not commit. Also here is his lawyer, Bruce Barquette. And Bruce, when did you get involved in the case?
I actually got involved in 2002 or so, and you introduced me as his lawyer, which is certainly true, but it should be noted that Barry Pollack, Steve Braga, and Jennifer O'Connor, among others, have been representing Marty now for 13 years.
You had an extraordinary legal team on your behalf, didn't you? Some very high-powered, very successful lawyers adopted your case a long time ago.
I was very fortunate. I worked with a girl and went to high school with Laura Teichman. And in 1995, she was a summer associate at the law firm of Miller, Cassidy, LaRocque, and Lewin in Washington, D.C.
Very distinguished, fancy law firm.
At that time, she presented my case to Barry Pollack, Kirsten Livingston, and Stephen Braga. And Stephen Braga and Barry Pollack have been on the case ever since. Kirsten moved on. She's with the Ford Foundation now. But over the years, there's been a transition of lawyers. But the core team has stayed on, even though they're with different firms now. And it's just been a great group of people.
But you had a direct appeal of your case. You lost. And then the legal question becomes, then what? Because you're not entitled to unlimited appeals. So, Bruce, as a legal matter, how did the case get reopened after his appeal was convicted? It was affirmed. After his conviction was affirmed.
Generally speaking, what happened was we went back to square one and began investigating again. And really, in that regard, J. Sal Peter deserves a tremendous amount of credit. In 1992, I believe.
Now, who was he?
Jay is the investigator that Marty's had working for him really since 2001 or so. And in 1992, a woman was at a cocktail party with Joe Creed. And I say a cocktail party. They were smoking marijuana. And she heard Creed mumble something about being involved in the Tankliff murders. She said something to somebody sometime later. Eventually, this information was given to the Suffolk DA's office, but they did nothing with it. In 2002, Jay took that information and said, well, if he said this to her, maybe he said it to other people. And he started to talk to individuals that were connected to Creedon.
And just pause for a moment. Who is Creedon?
Joe Creedon is a individual who's resided in the Selden, Port Jeff area of Long Island all his life. He is a career criminal. He's been convicted of multiple offenses. Brags about being a leg breaker for drug dealers. Testified on the stand at a post-conviction hearing that he collected drug debts for Todd Stuerman. Boasted about hurting individuals, assaulting individuals to extract money from them.
So the investigator hears from another person that Creedon had been boasting about some sort of involvement. And so he goes to look into Creedon's story as a way of trying to tease out what the real story of the murder was.
He goes back and says, who were the other individuals that have been arrested with Creedon? He goes to look at his co-defendant, saying maybe some of them know more about this crime than did this woman in 1992. And sure enough, he stumbled upon an individual named Glenn Harris. And Glenn Harris said, not only do I know what happened, I drove the car that night. And I brought Joe Creedon and Peter Kent to the Tankliff home, and they came out covered in blood with gloves and burned their clothes afterwards. And from there, we got a wealth of information from a number of different sources corroborating Harris's account, a number of individuals that Creedon made admissions to. We were able to establish the connections between Stuerman, Creedon, Kent, Harris, and on it went. And ultimately, that resulted in Marty's exoneration.
Now, Marty, who is Carlene Kovacs?
Carlene Kovacs is the woman who was at the get-together back in 1992 that heard Joseph Creedon admit his involvement in the murders.
And so she was the key. How did the investigator, his name is
J. Sal Peter.
How did he get involved? I mean, how did he choose to, Marty, just decide to take on this case?
It's an interesting story. In 1998, I was in the Suffolk County Jail after the Federal District Court remanded my case for a Batson hearing, and I met an inmate.
Whoa, you've been around the legal system for too long. What's a Batson hearing?
Batson hearing is there was racial discrimination in the jury selection process.
It's a hearing about jury selection in your case. Okay, so you're back in Long Island in 1998 after your conviction, but you're already sentenced to 50
correct.
Years to life.
And I met an inmate there by the name of Austin Olfin, who was represented by Bruce Marquette and J. Sal Peter. And he said, you know, if you're ever looking for a great PI and a great lawyer, you got to contact Bruce and Jay. I was down in Suffolk County for 2 or 3 days, went back up to state prison. During the next year or two, there was an article in Newsday about Bruce Marquette, J. Sal Peter, working on another case. Two people sent me that article. Approximately 2 years later, after first meeting Austin joined me in the state prison, and once again he reaffirmed how good Jay and Bruce was, and I decided to write Jay. Maybe a week after I wrote Jay a letter, he and I had a conversation. He said, if you're innocent, hire me. If you're guilty, don't waste my time. I said, where do I sign?
And he devoted 16, 17 years to your case.
7 years, approximately.
7 years.
Yeah.
I see that I'm doing the math wrong. Right. Seven years.
Maybe 17 years in actual time.
In actual time, because he was really the chief investigator. What you got a new hearing in front of a district court judge, a trial judge out in Long Island.
That's correct.
Where you essentially got to tell your whole story all over again.
We did. Although,
and when was that?
That was from June of 2004, and I think it ended in
July 20th, 2004 to December, 2006.
So it was not continuous. There were breaks.
It was approximately
19
months of hearings. There were breaks. There were new developments that caused us to have delays.
And at the end of that trial, that hearing, you lost again.
Well, I was returned to state prison.
Right.
And it was approximately 3 months later on, I think it was St. Patrick's Day, I made one of my daily phone calls to the lawyers, and it was one of those phone calls that said, well, we've got to talk. And I could just tell from the tone of everybody's voice that it wasn't good news.
So after all this work, after all these months of hearings, the judge out in Long Island affirmed your conviction, said it was legitimate. What was your reaction at that point? Now, here we're talking about 2006. So didn't that look like really your last shot?
No.
Why not?
Obviously I knew the system and I knew I had, you know, the ability to appeal it upon permission. And I just knew that we were right. Bruce could kind of explain in more detail.
We knew we were going to lose in Suffolk County. It is a...
Because a big part of this story that we can't really go into here is that there were a lot of intertwined connections between people in law enforcement in Suffolk County and people connected to this case. And I'm not suggesting that anything improper happened, but you may suggest that, but I'm not. And that's been a big part of this story.
It really has. I mean, prosecutors are always reluctant to overturn or consent to overturning convictions they obtained. And trial judges, for whatever reason, seem reluctant to do the same thing. We knew before we began the hearing, really, that we were going to lose at the trial level in Suffolk. And that was made clear to us. As Marty said, he was shipped back upstate before the judge issued a decision. I didn't take that as a good sign.
That doesn't seem to be a good sign. So it was only the Court of Appeals. The Appellate Division.
And we were very confident before the Appellate Division. We knew the strength of the case. We had upwards of 15 witnesses that implicated others in the crime. We had a false confession expert. We were able to tease out more inconsistencies between what the confession was and what the actual forensics showed. And so we were, as optimistic as you can be before an appellate court that we were going to do well there.
And Marty, where were you when you got the news that the Appellate Division had ruled in your favor and that you were entitled to a new trial?
In the law library.
You just did you were you allowed to receive a phone call,
no,
or did you call in? Give me the date.
December 21st.
December 21st of last year.
December of last year was a Friday. As usual, it was one of my multiple daily phone calls for the lawyers. I was in the Great Meadow Correctional Facility, and I called
the which one?
Great Meadow Correctional Facility.
Now, where is that?
Comstock, New York, near Saratoga Springs, Albany area.
Why were you moved from Auburn?
It's just common practice that, you know, sometimes you just get shifted around. I mean, I was in a total of, I think, 4 prisons in 6,338 days, which is very minimal.
That's not a lot at all. Were some prisons better than others?
When you're innocent, no prison is good.
Well, I'm sure that's true, but were some less awful than others?
No.
No, really? I mean, they were not particularly. The food better in one or anything like that? No.
The only difference is the availability of programs. Certain jails have, in some jails you can make soap, in some jails they make license plates, in some jails they make clothing. That's the big difference. I mean, every jail houses men in cages.
One question I'm sure a lot of people have is, how did you avoid just getting just so bitter and angry that you wanted to just withdraw from the whole process or all of society?
My family.
It really was the context.
If anybody knows my family and they know how motivated they are, I tell people the story about me getting out in January and telling my family I'll wait till September to go to college. And my cousin Ron said, no, you're going to go now. And I said, no, September. He said, no, you're going to go now. And even throughout my incarceration, I mean, there's a story back in 1992, I sent him a list of things I wanted him to do. Instead of him doing, he brought the list back up to me in prison and said, listen, you have the time to do them. You're going to do them. You're going to get yourself out and we will support you every step of the way.
Of your fellow prisoners, how many of them, what percentage had supportive families?
It's very difficult to determine because I wasn't friendly with that many of the prisoners. But there's quite a few. There's quite a few that learned how not to burn their bridges with their families. So they did have a lot of support.
Bruce, go ahead.
The real question for me, and I think for everybody, should be how many of these individuals are actually innocent? Marty had a tremendous legal team from some high-powered law firms. He had a tenacious investigator. He had the support of public and family, and he took him 17 and a half years and an appellate court to release him. There are individuals that are languishing in prison right now who come from poor families, who don't have these kinds of resources, who don't have the access to the lawyers, who don't have the education and sophistication to know how to ask for them, and yet they languish there.
And Marty, you certainly believe that. You believe that do you have a sense of what percent of your fellow inmates were innocent?
It's really hard to determine an exact percentage, but you know, even one person, it's too many.
Well, of course that's true, but I'm just trying to give people a sense of how big a problem this is. I mean, one person is way too big a problem. But do you think there are a lot of innocent people in New York State prisons?
Yes.
Again, we go back to the Innocence Project, which exonerated hundreds of people because of good science. Those people are not in jail because of bad science. They were in jail because of false confession, misidentification by witnesses, corrupt prosecutors, police that hide exculpatory information, bad judges, bad juries, bad defense attorneys. Those problems exist. So those hundreds of individuals who have been exonerated are literally the tip of the iceberg of innocent people that have been convicted all across the country. And it's not hundreds, it's not thousands, it's probably more like hundreds of thousands of individuals across the country who are wrongfully incarcerated for crimes they didn't commit. It is a tragedy in our system. And really, looking at Marty's case to see the struggle he went through for someone who's so obviously innocent, it makes one believe that the criminal justice system is in many ways a train wreck when it comes to convicting the innocent.
Marty Tankleff, what's next for you? You've got a few more semesters left at Hofstra. You are a young man. You're still in your 30s, so you've got a lot of decades of productive life out there. What are you going to do with the rest of your life?
Obviously, I want to finish my college degree first, move on to law school. I would love to help establish an Innocence Project or be associated with an Innocence Project, have family, kids. One of the biggest things is my family and I are not through with this investigation. My parents' killers are still roaming the streets. We will not stop till they are prosecuted and exposed.
That is an extraordinary story. Marty Tankleff, Bruce Barquette, thank you so much for joining us on the Leonard Lopate Show. Good luck. I'm not sure. I just think the state of New York owes you a big apology, and it is very good that the system worked, albeit very, very, very slowly.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.